Hey, buddy, I'm not paying you to hear your thoughts on life.
Well, I have a microphone, and you don't.
So you will listen to every damn word I have to say!
Allow myself to introduce myself.
Welcome to Season 3 of the Raise Your Game Show, a podcast that unpacks and dissects the strategies and principles of high performance in sports and business. I'm your host, Alan Stein Jr. In this season, I lean on several of the most innovative and impactful leaders I know to garner their wisdom on how to effectively lead during times of adversity, how to remain poised during a crisis, and how to look for and capitalize on new opportunities. While these Zoom recordings took place during the height of the coronavirus pandemic, the tips, strategies, and principles shared are timeless and can be applied to any future challenge. They also have very high utility. The wisdom dropped can and should be applied to any line of work, in any industry, in any organization. For additional resources on improving performance, leadership, and culture, please check out allensteinjr.com/free. Follow me at Alan Stein Jr. on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, and opt in to receive my full timeout, 30-second timeout, and overtime monthly emails. Today, I'm joined by Rick Simmons, the co-founder and CEO of the Telos Institute. Rick, one of the many things that you know, I have so much admiration and respect and appreciation for you as a leader, as a business person, you know, all of the above, is this concept of liminal space. And I think it's applicable at all times in our life, but is incredibly applicable now as we're all still continuing to navigate the COVID-19 crisis. Can you elaborate a little bit more on what liminal space is and why it's something that we should all be searching for and embracing?
Yeah, thanks, Alan. Well, I think, you know, if we look in the rearview mirror, I think we can all remember those periods of disruption, discontinuity, that in retrospect helped us move forward stronger, better, faster, all of those things. And we define liminal space, those periods of betwixt and between, periods of discontinuity that create an openness for change. And I think in the here and now, we see this idea of liminal space as an opportunity to recognize right now that we're in the midst of a period of disproportional opportunity to be better out the other side, as opposed to just looking at it in a rearview mirror sort of way. What if we knew that right now? I would tell you also, Alan, that you know, we're in the middle of that period right now, but I will also say it may be a year or two or three from now, and this idea of curating these periods of compression or liminal space and not having to wait around for the next pandemic is also a provocative proposition. Maybe we could actually create those periods of compression for ourselves and be able to iterate a little bit faster, even when the seas are calm.
I love that. So it sounds like most people experience liminal space, but they do so through hindsight, that they look back and go, man, that was a really uncomfortable time, but boy, look what emerged from it. So what you do so brilliantly is we're trying to create that. We're trying to embrace it and welcome it and actually make periods of liminal space. And certainly the one we're in now has been thrust upon us. But you're suggesting that we, moving forward, that we actually attempt to recreate this.
Yeah, I think we can. And you know, the leaders we've worked with will say out the other side, oh, I get it. Adversity plus reflection equals growth and progress. And the precious opportunity is to recognize when you're in one of those compressed states, those inflection points, and many leaders often tell us as well, oh, just recognizing where I was on that continuum was as helpful as anything in allowing me to harvest all the benefits that could come out the other side of it.
Now, you all do some really fully immersive retreats, and I don't even know if retreat does it justice to what you all provide, but liminal space is basically the concept behind that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've created what we call a landscape of liminal experiences, right? You know, you can immerse yourself for the period of just a single day. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in it, for example, Al, we live in a noisy, noisy world, right? Sometimes the lack of noise or even pure silence for an elongated single day can be wildly disruptive, you know, in the society and the world we live in today. So, you know, all the way from single day immersive experiences, all the way to, you know, week plus long excursions to destinations, bucket list type destinations around the world where you can immerse for a week or more, and all points in between. But whatever is right for that individual or that team or that organization at the time, choicefully in inserting themselves into those disruptive periods can have great value.
Oh, for sure. But I would imagine there needs to be some purpose and some intention for anyone that's looking to create a liminal space. It's not, you know, I mean, clearly I could smash my hand with a hammer and I'm going to be really uncomfortable, but I don't know that that's going to do anything to help me moving forward. So what are some of the guidelines on folks, whether they want to do something with you all, which I highly recommend, or they're just looking to grow themselves? What are some of the framework that you can put around that so that folks are creating an environment that is going to actually foster growth and improvement?
Yeah, I think, you know, first and foremost, liminal space is essentially a pattern breaking moment, right? And that moment can last, as I just mentioned, for, you know, any period of time. But I think we're looking for opportunities to create a break in pattern. So, you know, if you're thinking to yourself, hey, I want to try to create a carve out of space and time for myself that allows me, you know, to think about the habits, the choices I make every day, and course correct those. Breaking pattern is really the guideline that you want Don to use and leverage. I would say once you find yourself in those periods, that container of space and time where pattern has been broken, I think that simply naming and identifying that you're in that place, I know it sounds so fundamental and so simple, but I know I'm talking to the guy that preaches fundamentals better than anybody, so I know I can say that safely. But just really fundamentally talking about here's where I am, and using that then as the building blocks to be able to grow from is really important.
I gotcha. And is this something that should almost be scheduled as part of one's monthly or yearly routine? I mean, should a high performer, whether they're in sport or business or in any area of life, and whether they're trying to make a personal or a professional upgrade, I mean, is this something where they should say, hey, quarterly, this is something that I need to do for myself and invest in? And invest in can be obviously doing something with you all, or an investment of the time that they'll take to kind of step away to create that pattern. Like what would a high performer and a high achiever need to do on a monthly, quarterly, or yearly basis to really get the most out of this concept?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I was thinking recently, Kyle Korver, you know, the former NBA basketball player, maybe still playing, I'm not sure, but he talks about how he would create these inspiration experiences in the off season every year.
Yeah.
Like he would walk, one year he walked a certain length of period, he weighted himself all the way to the ocean floor and he walked like a certain length of time. It was like it focused his training. And then a different year, he did something really different, like this really disruptive kind of experience that he did every off season, which I thought was pretty cool. In much the same way, we encourage leaders and leadership teams to engage in a quarterly think week. And you know, it was years ago in our organization when we really didn't have the time or the resources to do this, but we just felt like getting away every quarter to immerse ourselves in unfamiliar surroundings and to deliberately and choicefully disrupt would have benefits for us. Mm-hmm. And we sort of just trusted that process. And if I look back and I point to the things that have helped catapult us forward, I think that's certainly one of those, Alan. My colleague, we were going off for one of these think weeks initially, and she said, hey, you know, have fun as you're sort of going off on this. And I said, wait a minute, you know, this is where we do the deep work. You know, this is really where the expenditure of energy from a brain perspective is at its maximum. And I would say that would be certainly something that I would encourage. They don't have to go away for a week. You know, we sort of took it to a certain extent, but I do think there's really something to the regular rhythm and cadence of immersing this. I think there's a fitness level that comes from it. Yeah. You can more readily and more deeply get into those periods of liminality when you get more practiced at it.
Absolutely. Well, I like that concept of looking to do that quarterly. You know, you take any of the professional sports, and obviously things have been thrown into a tizzy with COVID-19, but in an uninterrupted year, professional athletes have a very distinct off season. Then they have a distinct preseason, a preparation phase, and then they have the end season, which, you know, takes up a good portion of the calendar. But each of those different phases is an important role. And, you know, I know with NBA players, many of them in the beginning of the off season, they take the first couple weeks and they just step away. They get away from everything. They get away from the game. They get away from training. And they just kind of let their mind and body relax. And then they slowly build up and prepare for the preseason. And then in the season, you know, most folks in business don't really have an off season. They don't really have these breaks. You know, I mean, I know some businesses are seasonal, but for the most part, we're just going and we're on this treadmill or hamster wheel all of the time, unless you're intentional about taking steps away to have a mini off season or preseason to grow and develop. And it sounds like that's what you're highly recommending.
Yeah, I am. And you raise allude to a really good point there, Alan. I think, you know, shared experience is one of the greatest ways that we can drive cohesiveness. And I think that these periods, call them liminal space, these periods of choiceful immersion can drive this shared experience and the stickiness of that cohesiveness that's generated when you take time to get away like that, will stay with you when you get back to the same, you know, corner office kind of idea. So, you know, I think it has to be disruptive in nature to drive that degree of cohesiveness. But if you can really build that in, it has staying power for sure.
For sure. Now, from a business standpoint, and I don't know the metrics, but I know members of your team have shared with me before. The people that go through your different experiences, when they come out, I mean, first of all, it's almost as if they're a different person. I realize they're not a different person. They're just a better and improved version of themselves. But the number of people that say they would do this again, the number of people that say they would recommend this for someone else, the number of people that then refer a friend or a colleague or a coworker to come do these experiences with you are numbers that I've never seen before. What is it that makes you all so unique and so special to create something that once people have gone through this, they're never the same and they're thankful for that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's much the same in your work, Alan. I think that I was on a panel one time and somebody asked me a version of this question. And, you know, it dawned on me that to be great in this business of coaching and supporting corporate athletes, you just have to work with great corporate athletes. And I mean, I that's simply the fact of the matter. We've been just so lucky to work with people who are devoted to being great. And I think that it doesn't take a lot to dose in for folks that really are hungry and devoted to being great, to latch onto that and really level themselves up. So I think, you know, the first answer is when you work with great people, great stuff happens. And then I would just say, you know, quite honestly, that we've always come at this work with this idea that greatness lies latent within. And our job is simply to serve as an invitation to further invite all that greatness, that creativity, the ambition, the work ethic, all that stuff that's in there already. Just help them unpack it and repack it and reorganize it in a way for their benefit. And so I would say it's that, working with great people and, you know, honoring the greatness they have within.
But I've heard that the working with great people part is not an accident, that you all vet your clients very heavily, and you need to, they need to show an openness to be willing to do the work, be willing to step outside of themselves, because you all do something that I think other businesses should learn from. You sometimes turn people away because you don't believe they'd be a good fit for what you're trying to do. Talk a little bit more about that, because I know so many businesses would have a lot of trouble turning away a high-paying client or customer.
Yeah, well, this is true, and there is a tribal story we tell here at the Telos Institute years ago when, you know, we really couldn't afford to turn this particular retailing company located in Columbus, Ohio, and they had called and they were amidst a transition in culture and having a lot of internal strife, the kinds of things that we could have helped with. And you know, we wanted to honor the shift they were looking to make, but I think that there had to be some table stakes in place already that would really allow us to fully invest in them. And culturally there wasn't an alignment there. Some of their advertising practices didn't fit what we thought was appropriate. And we did say no to that engagement, and it was difficult. So I won't say that it was easy. You know, there is a pull there. But I think what it does is it sets a relationship up for success. You know, I encourage clients to ask themselves three questions, and we are asking ourselves the same three questions all the time. You know, the first question is, do you need help? Right? Which is, you know, I often use golf as an example, a silly example. Like, I probably need a golf lesson, Alan, you know, with four kids and, you know, not a lot of time these days. I probably need a golf lesson and would benefit from it. Do I want a golf lesson? No, it's not really important to me and where I'm at in life right now to use that, but they are different questions. So I think you have to need it, you have to want it. And then, you know, do you feel 100% confident we're the firm that can help you address the critical pivotal needs that you have to help you level up and move forward? And if you can get yes on all three of those, then I think we've got an opportunity to do some good work. But those yeses have to come on both sides.
Yeah.
And I think that when we felt like those instances, we didn't get three yeses on our side. We didn't really want to be invested with this, vested with this organization. Those are the instances we've tapped out, said no, and I think have served us well in the long run.
Absolutely. Wow. Yeah. That's great. And I love that it needs to be a fit going both ways, because that's what any relationship is. It can't ever just be one-sided. Now I guess on more of a personal level, talk to me. You know, there's a couple things that really impressed me in this world. One is high performance and high achievement, which clearly you are and you've done. But the other is consistency and longevity, which you've done as well. What are some of your keys, for managing stress on the acute level, for avoiding stagnation and plateauing kind of as a mid-level, and then now that you've been doing this for a while, how you've been able to navigate around and alleviate burnout? And I'm sure that you've already touched on some of those points with what you've been talking about with liminal space, but anything else you have to add on what keeps your fire going and what keeps you performing at a high level after all these years?
Well, how much time do you have?
All that you need, my friend.
Right. Well, I'll keep it brief. So I think at a base level, I was really lucky. I had a 10th grade teacher, and I remember like it was yesterday, Alan, sitting in class with him, and he was a computer science instructor. And one day it was a cold Northeast Ohio winter morning, and sitting in class, and he said to us, the secret to success is a system. And I thought, that was a nugget of gold right there, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and he went on to say that the system isn't the same in every context or every situation, but finding a system. And I think that routine and cadence has always been a really big part of my operating system, my operating model. You know, I've become more aware of it over time, but I think the secret to success really is a system. And Michael Pollack gave me that gift many years ago as a 10th grader, and I remember that to this day. So whether it be identifying my own rhythm and cadence every day, every week, every month, it's super important for me. And I would say, rhythm without some continuity and novelty is also an equal miss. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I try to infuse a sense of continuity and novelty into that. And I think they create the right counterbalance for one another. A foundation of consistency that I can lean against when stress is high, when I'm in the tall grass, and a degree of novelty that creates the spice of life. And it really does. So I think the counterbalance of those two things is really important. And I also would just at the higher level, Alan, I will say, we were asked by a trusted colleague here in our organization many years ago. Dan asked me, he said, what is the gift that you want Telos to give the world? And I really appreciate and continue to value the question that he shared there. And it's something that really continues to drive me today, because what I've learned about that question is that it can grow and it can evolve.
Yes.
The gift I thought I wanted the organization to give 5 years ago is different to today. And I just love continuing to chase that question.
I love that. So it's almost a constant reinvention. It's a reevaluation, and you're continually looking internally, probably personally and collectively as the Telos Institute, and saying, okay, how can we update the answer to that question? And that's going to create some minor pivots and refocusing of the lens so that you can continue to to reevaluate all of the time and then move forward. I love that.
Yeah, and I think the subtlety in that also is that, as I think you can see, is that it shifts the mind from what do we want or need to obtain, and it turns it to this insatiable, never-ending desire to give.
Yeah,
and there's no end to that, right? It's not, what do we want to obtain or collect for our own benefit? It's now completely changes the tables, and I have enjoyed and benefited from the vastness of how that definition has changed over the years.
I love that. And even though at present, a lot of us are focused kind of on COVID-19, I think that the themes that we're pulling out of this have very high utility, and we can and should apply them moving forward to a variety of different things. Hopefully we're not going to experience a crisis on this level for a while. And I would imagine that many of your clients and the high performers that you work with, when this first hit, 4, 8, 6 weeks ago, you were trying to help them acclimate to a new normal and get in a new rhythm based on the social distancing and quarantining. But then, of course, that pendulum is going to swing in the other direction at some point. Of course, we don't know when. And they're going to have to reacclimate to what is going to be the new normal moving forward. What are some of the things that you're doing to help them prepare? And what are some things that you think moving forward are never going to be the same again? Business pre-COVID-19 and business post-COVID-19.
Yeah. So a couple things there. Just, at a real fundamental level, Alan, one of the things that we've seen is I think the best amongst us are eager and working hard to infuse three things, right? We want to infuse a true sense of empathy with those people that we interact with. We want to drive levels of trust across those that we interact with. And we want to provide a vision or a way forward to those that we're charged with working with. Here's the watch out though on that. I think that it can be easy to misalign that. And what I mean by that is what we have found is that at the one-on-one level, that's the most fuel efficient time to infuse empathy. Alan, how are you? How's your family? How are you managing through this? Because you can imagine if you tried to do that at an enterprise-wide meeting, it becomes a big muddy mess in some ways, right? It's less fuel efficient, if you will. So I think empathy is delivered best at the one-on-one level. Trust, did we do what we said we were going to do on time to the level of rigor that we all agree upon? I think the team level is the point where you want to try to over-index trust. And then I think at the organization level, the enterprise-wide level, is where you really want to emphasize this idea of vision and a way forward. And I think that's a really simple construct or a framework, but it's something I've used and I've seen leaders use that we're working with really effectively. It's not to the detriment of those other elements, but really just prioritizing and aligning those in that way, I think can subtly be significant in how you interact with those populations.
I love that. So what would you recommend for someone that is at the enterprise level that has hundreds, possibly thousands of people on their team to make sure that empathy is trickling down appropriately? If it's not realistic for me as the CEO to individually call all 1,000 of my people to check in and see how they're doing, what's a way that I can still make sure that my people know that I care about them and forge the relationship as much as possible in a realistic and practical way?
Yeah. Yeah, and this reminds me of a conversation I had this morning, Alan. My colleague Angela Forster and I were on a call this morning with an organization, and I had shared with them that as far back as 1985, as a kid, I was curious about what separated those that make it and those that don't. Why do some distinguish in business and industry and others don't? I thought every kid thought about those things. Come to find out. Yeah. Not a lot do, but I will.
I love it.
And I thought about that. I devoted a graduate school experience to answering some of those questions. And so one of the folks on this call said, well, Rick, what'd you discover? What'd you learn? What is the differentiating component? And it made me think of you, Alan, because I think the real difference is the ability to create teams and to scale the ability to build and create productive working teams. And there's nobody I know that does it better than Alan Stein. So I think it really speaks to the work that you do. The fundamentally important nature of raising your game, I think, is expressed in that realization from my part. And I think it speaks to your question, which is, you know, the best way I think we can infuse that degree of empathy is to deliver that to our team. You know, team one. And once we get that right on our team, it sets the stage. You know, human beings are mimicking machines. And so if we can create that experience on team one, then we have a high likelihood for that to be replicated deeper in and throughout the organization. So it sounds enticing to say, how do I reach 10,000 people? But I think the first step is to reach 8 people really deeply, really effectively, and then charge them with reaching 8 more people. And the network effect comes into play.
I love it. And this still holds true with the mindset of, you want, you know, an organization shouldn't have a leader. It should be comprised of leaders. I mean, all 1,000 of those people should consider themselves leaders and want to be the best teammate that they're capable of. So they should want to be reaching out to each other to make sure everyone else is okay. And they should want to consider themselves a leader, not everyone just kind of staring blankly at the screen, waiting for the top person on the org chart to orchestrate every move. So no, I think that's brilliant. Last question for you. What are some of the personal pivots you've made? I mean, you talked about how important rhythm and continuity is to you in your life. And clearly that was disrupted, you know, 4, 6, 8 weeks ago. How easily were you able to adapt and create a new rhythm and cadence just with your own personal wellness and fitness mentally and emotionally?
Yeah. You know, I think there's assumptions we make about people, whether, you know, you interact with pro athletes a lot, I interact with titans of business and industry a lot. I think there's a lot of assumptions we make about those folks that it comes easier for them. Now, I acknowledge it's easier for some to dunk a basketball than others, but I think the day-to-day choices that people make are not necessarily any easier, you know, for us than they are for those folks. And so, you know, I think where the rubber really meets the road, I guess is a long way of expressing, you know, it's not easy for any of us.
No.
And choicefully making those pivots. And, you know, I again, a nod to your content, Alan, because, you know, I've really infused, doubled down on my meditation practice during this. I've been a longtime user of Headspace. Awesome. And I think that, you know, hearing Andy in my head on a regular basis is really helpful. And I think that I've had to recalibrate my fitness objectives as well. And I've choicefully introduced some things that I'm doing, the bike. I've long been a runner and a weightlifter in different realms. But it's really been helpful for me to introduce play as a component into this period. And the bike has become a way to introduce some play and some other things I've done as well. But you know, not easy, not a foregone conclusion to keep those things fresh and in play. And, you know, I think we can lean on each other for that, for sure. Collectively.
Always. Yeah. I remember Jim Rohn said something to the effect of the things that are easy to do are also easy not to do. I mean, it's at one level you can say it's easy for me to wake up and meditate. It's just as easy to wake up and not meditate, and really your results and your happiness and your fulfillment and your achievement and success are just going to be a culmination of how consistently you do those things. But yes, you're 100% right. That's not necessarily easy for anybody. You know, for me, what I just kept, I was admittedly a little down in the dumps the first couple of weeks that this occurred. I mean, I was anxious. I was disappointed. I love being on stage, and to see events canceled, you know, was very disappointing. But once I got myself out of that funk, I just said, okay, whenever this ban is lifted and this is going to be over, I want to make sure that I'm a better version of myself than when it started, mentally, physically, and emotionally. So what are the things I have to do every day so I can build it brick by brick to make sure that when this is over, I'm going to be better? And in some of those areas, it's had to take some creativity. You know, I'm used to taking a yoga class where I just follow what they say. I'm used to going to the gym and doing a very specific routine. Now I can't do any of those things. So now I've had to be kind of creative. And I love the way that you said you added free play in and to make things different and spice it up. I think this can be a time where innovation and creativity takes all of us to new heights, but you're 100% right. This isn't easy for anybody to go through.
Yeah. And I will just circle back to this notion of liminal space. As an organization, we said to ourselves, what are the 3 or 4 things that out the other side of this, whether that's a week, a month, or 6, whatever it may be, how will we choicefully be be better, faster, stronger, leaner because of this situation. And I hear a lot of that, you know, in your comments as well, Alan.
That's perfect. Well, any parting words you want to say before we say our goodbyes, my friend?
I just want to express gratitude to you, Alan. You've been a source of inspiration to me, to countless numbers of others. Your reach out to drive this conversation just means a lot to me. And I just want you to know that you're changing lives out there. I'm one of those, and just appreciate you immensely. So thank you for this time and for your regular content.
The feeling's very, very mutual. Your mentorship, your friendship, and your leadership have impacted me in ways that you don't know. So thank you so much. Keep up your great work, and let's enjoy a little bit more liminal space.
Onward.
Awesome. Thanks, brother.
Thanks, Alan.
Well, that's it for us. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. For more killer free content, make sure you check out allensteinjr.com/free. Join me at allensteinjr on all major social platforms and subscribe to my full timeout, 30-second timeout, and overtime monthly emails. I look forward to helping you raise your game.